December 7th, 1941, a day that will live in infamy, as President Roosevelt said. And we're going to honor the folks that were around at that time, the folks that gave their lives for their country at Pearl Harbor. And sitting in the studio with me this afternoon is Fred Malone. Fred?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And we'll be hearing in a little bit from Don Wilson, who is a World War II vet.
Absolutely, and fought in the Pacific.
So I have a few stats if you want me to give them.
Sure, go right ahead.
And you have plenty of notes.
I do.
There were 2,403 people killed.
Mm-hmm.
There were 1,178 injured. There were 4 battleships sunk. In the area of aircrafts, there were 188 destroyed, 159 damaged. The attack started at 7:55 on that Sunday morning and lasted about an hour and 15 minutes. And this is, of course, the 79th anniversary of that event.
Today.
Yes. So, Fred?
Well, I have to thank Brandy Wilson, our director at the Marion County Historical Society, for going back into the archives and pulling up some Marion Star editions from December the 7th and December the 8th, and also the 11th and 12th and a couple other days in December that I wanted to talk about. The Marion Star actually put out a special edition on December the 7th. It was an evening paper. It was an extra. And I can just see in my mind's eye the kids on the street downtown Marion hawking newspapers, yelling, "Extra, extra,
sure.
Read all about it." And the headlines for that day in bold letters at the top of the Marion Star read, "Japan attacks U.S. Pacific bases without warning. Battles on sea and in air follow. 350 killed at the airfield. President calls cabinet." Now, there are a number of stories in that paper, and a couple I'm going to highlight when we get a little bit further into this. There was a Marion soldier on the front page of the paper that day. There was a Marion soldier that was serving in the Philippines at that time, and we have a little bit of information about him. And then there was another Marion man that had been in the Navy and had once been in the area, who was actually back in Marion at the time of the bombing. And there was a little bit of an article in here about him. We'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes, too. But since you led off with a day that lived in infamy.
Which I stated something wrong. I said that he said that day. He didn't say
it was actually the 8th. Right.
Yes.
It was actually on the following day, on the 8th, because the attack occurred on a Sunday. But I did get the text of that speech, and I would like to read that speech.
Sure.
Our guest is supposed to be with us about 5:30 by phone, so hopefully we'll get this done and a couple other things before he calls. But this was Mr. President, or Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate and of the House of Representatives. Yesterday, December the 7th, 1941, a day which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. Indeed, 1 hour after Japanese air squadrons had commenced bombing in the American island of Oahu, the Japanese ambassador to the United States and his colleague delivered to our Secretary of State a formal reply to a recent American message. And while this reply stated that it seemed useless to continue the existing diplomatic negotiations, it contained no threat or hint of war of an unarmed attack. It will be recorded that the distance of Hawaii from Japan makes it obvious that the attack was deliberately planned many days or even weeks ago. During the intervening time, the Japanese government has deliberately sought to deceive the United States by false statements and expressions of hope for continued peace. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that many American lives have been lost. In addition, American ships have been reported torpedoed on the high seas between San Francisco and Honolulu. Yesterday, the Japanese government also launched an attack against Malaysia. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Hong Kong. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Guam. Last night, Japanese forces attacked the Philippine Islands. Last night, the Japanese attacked Wake Island. And this morning, the Japanese attacked Midway Island. Japan has, therefore, undertaken a surprise offensive extending throughout the Pacific area. The acts of yesterday and today speak for themselves. The people of the United States have already formed their opinions and well understands the implications to the very life and safety of our nation. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense, but always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us. American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. I believe that to interpret the will of the Congress and of the people when I assert that we will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us. Hostilities exist. There is no blinking at the fact that our people, our territory, and our interests are in grave danger. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God. I ask that Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December the 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
And that was
President Franklin Delano Roosevelt on December the 8th to the Congress of the United States, combined joint session between the Senate and the House of Representatives. And of course, needless to say, Congress accepted that and did confirm that, and we were at war, effective immediately. There were some bulletins in that newspaper that I wanted to mention, and I have to use my cheater here to read this. It's very small.
It is very small print.
It is very small print. But the bulletin that appeared on the front page of the extra edition of the Marion Star on that particular day, Washington, December the 7th, the White House announced at 3:22 p.m. Marion time, and as you said, it was, what time was it in the morning down there?
7:55.
7:55. Mm-hmm. It was 3:22 in Marion. Today has been, today that an Army transport carrying bombers, a lumber rather than the troops, had been torpedoed 1,300 miles west of San Francisco. This placed Japanese naval action well east of Hawaii toward the mainland. There was no information of whether the transport had been sunk or whether there was a loss of life among the crew. So obviously, as he said in his text to Congress, they were attacking other places in the Pacific, not just Pearl Harbor.
Right.
Also in the December 7th paper, there was a mention of two particular men that had been serving or had served in that particular area. One soldier had been serving in the Philippines at the time of the attacks, and his name was Homer Dutt. His family was Mr. and Mrs. Henry Dutt, and they lived on Hayne Avenue. He was in a tank machinery and was a private that was sent to the Pacific only a few weeks before the attack occurred. He had gotten his training and was on part of a tank detachment out of Knox, Kentucky. Don't know whether he has any people still living in Marion or not, but the last name was Dutt, and his name was Homer Dutt. Also in this same paper, a Marion Navy man, the headlines, a Marion Navy man once in the war area. This particular article is about a Charles F. Silber of 409 South Vine Street. He was a naval recruiting officer, and he had been several years in service in the Pacific Battle Zone. At the particular time of the bombing, he was back in Marion, but he ranked as a chief water tender, served twice in the area where Japan launched its attack at Pearl Harbor. In the early 30s, he was stationed aboard a destroyer from 1935 to 37. Was on a naval transport plying the waters between the United States, Hawaii, Manila, Guam, and China bases. He pointed out that the American Defense Forces in the Pacific had been on guard for years, making frequent air patrols and maintaining a constant 24-hour guard of vital positions. His last particular service had been with the Atlantic Fleet on the USS Texas. Obviously, the Japanese, as Roosevelt said, had been planning this attack for quite some time. And even though peace talks were going on between the two countries, they were obviously pulling the wool over our eyes the whole time that they were doing this. So, but interestingly enough, people in Marion, by way of the newspaper, were getting up-to-date news. And, of course, they had radio in those days, so they were able to get a number of reports and information from the radio. So they were being kept up on what was going on. It took quite a few days, obviously, before they could determine just exactly how many lives were lost, because, of course, a couple of the battleships had been totally sunk.
Right.
And men were trapped, obviously, you know, in these battleships, especially guys that had worked below decks and were not able to get up when the attack, you know, when the attack came. So, continuing on with the things that were found in the paper on December the 8th, obviously the day that Roosevelt made his speech to the Congress, that might be our call-in.
Well, let me find out here real quick.
All right.
Yep, it is. Okay, talk. Yes, it's Don. Okay, I'm going to switch a couple of buttons here and put you on the air with Fred and me. Hold on a second. Okay.
Are you there, Don?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, Don, how you doing today?
Good, how are you, Fred?
I'm absolutely great. Just for everyone's to know who we're talking to Don Wilson, a resident here in Marion. And we've got some questions for Don. And Don, I gave you a list of questions the other day that I wanted to ask you, and then we may have a few others. So,
well, that's all right.
First of all, when and where were you born, Don?
I was born in Washington Courthouse, Ohio, February the 2nd, 1924.
So you're going to have a birthday coming up here in a couple of months.
I sure am. Well, I'll only be 97.
You're just a young man, Don.
I know it.
Well, as I told you, we're talking about Pearl Harbor today, 79 years ago today. Do you remember the day?
I surely do. Yes, boy, I surely do.
Where were you when you heard about the attack?
I was home when I heard about it. Of course, I was still in high school. I graduated in 1942, so I was still in high school when this happened. But I heard about it, and of course, the first thing went through my mind. I said, well, I got to get with this military and see what it can do to help.
So that was your first thought then, about you were thinking about just as soon as you graduated, you were going to go in?
Yes, that's what I had in mind, yep.
So how soon after the event did you actually enlist?
I enlisted in, I think it was March of 44. It's hard to remember back those dates.
Oh, Fred. Sure. I understand. I understand.
But my brother was in the Air Force, and he was in England, in the 8th Air Force. And I thought, well, I would try to maybe get over there. But it wasn't going very good with my mother. She didn't go for that at all.
She didn't like the idea of you even going in the service since your brother was already in.
Exactly. Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Now, did you? I know you ended up going in the Navy. Did you particularly want to go to the Navy, or mentioned you wanted to go to the Air Corps first?
I wanted to go in the Army Air Corps because I saw P-51s, and I wanted to be a pilot. And that was great. I did take the mental test for pilot in the Army Air Corps.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't pass physical.
Now, what was your brother, what was he doing with the Army Air Corps?
Well, he was like a mechanic on B-17.
Oh, okay. All right. How much older was he, Don?
He was, he was like 2 years older than I am.
2 years old. Okay.
Yeah.
So then, when you couldn't get in the Army Air Corps, were your next thoughts the Navy?
It sure was. Yep.
And where did you actually enlist?
I enlisted in Columbus, but I was sent to Chicago at the
Great Lakes?
For boot camp, yeah, Great
okay,
Lakes.
Great Lakes, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What made you choose the Navy?
I thought, well, maybe I could get in the aboard a carrier or something like that. And while I was in the, in the training there in Chicago, well, they'd come around, they said, we need people for the Air Force and we need people for submarines. I said, no. I said, there's no place to run to when you're in a submarine.
That's right. You're pretty well trapped.
Yeah. So I did. I applied for that, and they sent me to Aviation Radio School in Memphis, Tennessee.
Ah, okay. Now, when you got in the Navy then, you got on a carrier, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what was the name of the carrier? I've forgotten.
The Kitkin Bay.
Kitkin Bay.
Yeah, Kitkin.
Okay. I remember you have talked about that before. And you ended up flying on what type of aircraft?
A torpedo bomber, TBM torpedo bomber. I was a radio tail gunner. Well, they called me bombardier too.
Yeah, because you actually had, not only you had control of the radio, but you also had a gun that you could use, right?
Yeah, I had a 30 caliber machine gun behind me. It was a handy outfit. You know, it kept Jap Zeros from sneaking up behind you.
Yeah, now that was a three-man crew, right?
Right, yes. Pilot, turret gunner, and then me as a radio man
and
gunner.
And those TBMs were referred to, the one you were on referred to as an Avenger, am I correct there?
That's correct, oh, yes.
Okay. Now, the carriers that you flew off of, they weren't a standard aircraft carrier, were they? Were they like a shorter carrier? Or?
Yeah, they were called a CVE, what we call them, baby aircraft carriers.
Okay.
They were very short. You couldn't fly off of them. You had to be catapulted off.
Okay, so every time you climbed into the plane, they stretched a big rubber band and shot you off the end.
Exactly, yeah. And you better have the engine going properly, or you wouldn't, take a dip in the ocean. You
sure.
Didn't like that.
Now, you were what were you, 18 or 19 when you got in the Navy then?
Yeah, I was 18, really. Well, 18 and a half, I guess.
Now, who in your crew, how old was your pilot?
He was 22. I
oh,
think.
My gosh, he was an old man.
Yeah, he was. He was an old guy, yeah. Gunner was my age. Yeah.
So nobody in your crew was over the age of 22?
No,
That's just hard to believe. It's just absolutely hard to believe.
Yep.
So how soon after you got in the Navy were you actually sent to fight in the Pacific?
Well, that was in March of 44, if I remember right, we were sent out to the Pacific.
And did you see some action right away?
No. We were roaming around the Pacific Ocean. I don't know whether we were just roaming around like a bunch of lost people, but we were. Of course, there were others with us. We had a couple of destroyers, and our carrier had been hit before in the Battle of Lady Gulf. It took a kamikaze.
Oh my! While you were on board?
No, I wasn't on it. No. I was flying.
Oh, okay. You were up in the air.
Yeah.
I know you told me a couple of times that you thought you had a really good pilot because maybe there were a few times that you weren't sure you were going to come back.
Exactly, yeah. And I think it's probably because I said he's a bit crazy. Maybe that craziness brought us back. I don't know.
Well, that could very well be. That could very well be. Yeah.
Yeah, there was a time we were on fire, and I was pretty sure that was it.
That was it. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So, how many torpedoes on board that particular aircraft?
One.
Just one torpedo?
One torpedo, and it would carry four 500-pound bombs if you didn't have the torpedo.
I see. I see. So it was either the four bombs or the one torpedo.
Yeah.
Okay, and depending on what kind of a mission they sent you on, then that would determine what you were going to be loaded with.
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, I think you mentioned that your mom wasn't too crazy about you enlisting at the time. What was your dad's opinion?
He didn't seem to care.
Yeah. One way or the other, huh?
No, he thought it was a good idea.
Well, obviously, Don, at the time, it was a different time. People,
yeah.
I think there was more patriotism going on in the country in those days, and we pulled together because we had one common cause. I don't think if it ever happened again, we would be in the particular shape that we were in then, depending on the way the country looks
you
now.
You know, all of us, our main objective was to save our country.
Absolutely.
And no matter what it took to save our country, we were going to do it.
Well, that has to be true, Don, because you were willing to give up your life to do it, and a lot of them didn't come back. You know, that's the sad part of the story.
For sure. My best man didn't make it.
Yeah, you've told me that story before.
Yeah.
Maybe you should mention that on the while we're here. To tell us that story.
Yeah, he was like, when we were in training, he and I were always matched up for hand-to-hand combat because we were very near the same size.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got married in the Navy, and he was my best man, and he was just like a brother to me. I even miss him yet.
Oh, I'm sure.
And we were sitting in, when we got shipped to the West Coast, he and I were sitting in this chow hall just talking, and this officer came in and was talking to both of us, and the officer says, "Come on, Glenn." His name was Glenn Heath. Mm. "You're going with us." And I never saw him again.
Oh, my.
But then I found out that he had gone on a mission, and the Japs apparently had fired on him, and they hit the plane right in the middle and blew it apart.
Oh, my. What kind of a plane was he on, do you know?
Torpedo plane, yes.
He was on a torpedo plane also.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Wow. And when I went back to Pearl Harbor here about 4 years ago with my nephew and his wife, we were at that punch bowl,
mm-hmm.
and found his name on the missing in action.
Oh, yeah.
He and another fellow that was at my wedding, they were both killed.
Where were you married, Don?
In Memphis.
In Memphis, Tennessee.
Yeah.
Well, I think Mike has some questions for you, too. I do want to mention to folks that you are my hero. I have told you that before many times. And I have Don's picture in his flight suit hanging on the wall alongside of my two uncles that served in the war, one in the Army and one in the Army Air Corps. So the three of you are my heroes. So I'm going to have Mike. Go ahead.
I consider the heroes of the... Like Glenn, it didn't come back.
That's right. I agree. Right. I agree.
I agree with that, too.
Well, you're my living hero. Mike, go ahead. I know you have some questions for him.
Did you know anybody personally that lost their life at Pearl Harbor?
Not at Pearl. No, I didn't. Because they were in... When that happened, I was in high school yet.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, so I didn't know anybody personally.
This may be kind of a strange question, but what kind of feelings were you having when you heard that? Was it anger? Was it?
It was anger, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But it was more. I thought somehow we're going to have to get after those people. We're going to have to win this war, no matter what it takes.
Yes.
Even if we lose our lives.
Okay.
Just protect our country.
Yes, sir. I agree 100%. And I'm sure there was a big rush of people to enlist in the different branches of the armed forces.
Oh yeah, they were lined up all over. You know, everybody had the same attitude. We're going to win it.
Yes, we could use that attitude today. That's for sure.
I think so. You got it.
Well, did you have anything else?
Yeah, I was going to ask, Don, when did you get out of the service?
I got out in, I think it was January of 46, after the war, you know. We had been dropping supplies to these prisoners of war in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
After, you know, when the war was over, because those guys had it tough.
Oh, yeah.
Prisoners of war people. Oh. And that's the reason, too, that I had it against the Japanese. You know, I still have, and I can't help it.
Well, the treatment that the guys received in the POW camp was horrible. Yeah, much worse than the Germans.
Yeah, I talked to this one big old guy. He said that every morning the Japs would get him out and make him stand like an attention, and had two Japanese behind him with their bayonets against his neck, stuck in his neck, and they get the littlest Jap they could find, put him on a box, and hit him in the jaw with his fist.
Oh, boy. Isn't that terrible?
I said different things like that, and I talked to two of them that had bayonet wounds in their legs. Mm. The Japs didn't want to kill them. They just wanted to hurt them.
Yeah, yeah. Just injure them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, when you think about the Bataan the Bataan Death March and some of the things that took place in the Pacific,
exactly.
It was not a pleasant place to be at all.
Absolutely. No, sure wasn't.
No.
Yeah.
Well, Don, unless there's something else you want to add. Oh, Mike has another question.
I just wondered, how do you think being this close to Christmas, did that change your Christmas a lot?
Well, when you say change my Christmas luck?
A lot, I'm sorry.
Oh.
We have our mask on here, so.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it really does, you know, because of some of the guys that I knew that I've lost, that I can't help it.
Sure, it just brings back those feelings.
Sure does.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, the mood of the country obviously was, at the time, was in that mood that we're going to win this, and people pulled together and did what they had to do, and you were one of those that did and came home. We were fortunate enough and that you did come home, and I know that those of us that know and love you are proud that we do, and we appreciate every day that you're with us.
Well, you know, Fred, really and truthfully, had it not been for the civilians and the sacrifices they made,
yes,
we wouldn't have made it.
You're right, yeah.
Because, you know, they were, you know, they even had to worry about eating.
Well, sure. People gave up a lot.
Gave up
Absolutely
a lot.
Did.
So it was,
yeah.
It was a complete combined effort by everybody in the country.
Yeah, it really was. It really was. Something we've not seen since.
That's right.
Yeah,
no, we haven't.
Sense. Well, Don, thank you so much for calling in. We really appreciate it. And
you're welcome, Fred.
We think about you all the time.
I know you do. Yeah, I know you do.
Well, God bless you.
And thank you for your service. We sure appreciate it. Like,
absolutely.
Like Fred
said. Thank you, Mike.
And I'll be talking to you soon.
Okay,
all
Fred.
Right. Take care.
Yes, sir. Bye.
Bye. A remarkable individual.
Oh, yes.
96 years old, soon to be 97, and just as spry as you can imagine. Yeah, he's just a fabulous person.
But he's got person. Such a story to tell. And
yeah, and it's a story that unfortunately there aren't too many of these guys left that can tell that story. And you know, we're so lucky that we have an opportunity to talk to Don today, especially today of all days. You know, on the 79th anniversary of the attack, to be able to share some time with him and to listen to his thoughts and his story. And I've heard a lot of his, you know, he's talked to me quite a bit, and some of the things that they go through and those men went through, and the sacrifices that they made and their families made, too,
oh,
the
sure.
sacrifices their families made. I know in my own family, my mother lost lost one brother in the war. Had two in the war, one in the Army Engineer Corps, and one in the Army Air Corps as a co-pilot. Navigator, I'm sorry. And he didn't come home. So, you know, those families made big sacrifices.
Well, I think the family dynamics have changed with men going off to war than the women going into the factory
sure,
work.
Sure, absolutely.
To make the things that were needed to fight the war.
The Rosie the Riveter.
Those
types of things. Well, what kind of time do we have left here?
We are down to about 11 minutes,
okay.
12 minutes.
I wanted to share some of the things that were in the subsequent newspapers that followed up the December 7th paper. On December the 8th in the Marion Star, big headlines on this particular article that came out. It says, Council to go into action. And I'm going to read the information here because I think it's quite interesting. An emergency meeting of the new Marion City County Defense Council will be held on Tuesday night at 7:30 to study plans for safeguarding the Marion area. So they had to form a particular group for defense. And, of course, civil defense was popular in those days, too. So Mayor Russell Snare made that announcement today. The meeting called as a result of the outbreak of hostilities with Japan will be held in the mayor's offices at City Hall. Mayor Snare said the city has received no special instructions since the war began yesterday, but that he expects more detailed information within the near future. And I'm sure that as things progressed in Washington, and from what I've read, they were starting to set up these civil defense posts all throughout the United States. The council, he said, undoubtedly will devote most of the deliberations to the prevention of sabotage in Marion's many factories, which are engaged in important national defense work. And, of course, we all know there were munitions made in Marion.
Sure.
Very big part of the war. The mayor said he has received an unofficial estimate that Marion's manufacturing industries, on an average, are devoting 80% of their operations to defense work, indicating that there is great need for watchfulness. Of course, remember, this was pushing us into the war. We hadn't been in the war up until this time. And the war in Europe had been raging since, 38, 39, something like that. So the war was already going on when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Guards on duty, Marion's factories already have established guards, he said. The council probably will make suggestions to the heads of industries concerning further protection for those factories. The police department, the mayor said, has some generalized information received some time ago. And the possibility of fire damage in this area, other than that from the usual peacetime hazards, is also an increasing problem, the mayor said. And I'm sure that they were probably thinking, especially on the coastlines, that if they could attack Pearl Harbor, they could send submarines across the ocean and attack both of our coasts. So I know in places like California, Washington, Oregon, New York, you know, Vermont, Maine, all the way down the East Coast and the West Coast, that there were a lot of interest being taken in watching those coastlines. And, of course, the Coast Guard was pressed into duty, obviously, to guard those coasts. So, again, you know, we were starting to see a lot of defenses building up. In the Marion Star on December the 11th, there was an article about Roger Bowman. Roger S. Bowman, who enlisted at the Marion recruiting station 3.5 years ago, is one of the many men from this area that were located in the danger zone of the Pacific. Mr. Bowman, who is 22, is a baker at the receiving station at the Pearl Harbor Naval Base where the Sunday bombing occurred. So he was there at the time, working at the receiving station. He had previously served 18 months on a transport and was transferred to the naval base about 3 months ago. So that would have been, along about October that he arrived in Pearl. He was a graduate of Ashley High School with a class of 1937. The last word received from him by his mother, Mrs. Bertha Engel of Richwood, was 4 weeks ago when he expressed fear that the base would be attacked.
Oh, really?
So when he talked to his mother a month prior to this, they were thinking about attack then. But, of course, who would expect attack early Sunday morning?
Right. That was just it. That was why it was such a... I have a question, Fred. Maybe you can answer. Were they already making munitions and so on here in Marion, or did that just start with the bombing of Pearl Harbor?
I don't think it got started until then, because we weren't actively involved in the war until after Pearl Harbor.
Right.
So I don't think that occurred until after that. I have to check the dates at the Historical Society, but I don't think so.
And why would Marion be such a prime place to do that? I think I know the answer.
Well, my guess is, and I'm not quite sure I'm totally right on this, but my guess is the access to the railroads.
That's what I'm thinking, yeah. too, yes.
Yeah. Because still in the 40s, you know, railroads were still a prime for the prime transportation of goods throughout the United States. We didn't get the interstate highway system until Eisenhower came along in the 50s.
Right, right.
So that would be my guess, and I'm guessing we're right. Yeah, I'm probably right.
Am I right in saying that they held prisoners of war at the depot out here on 309?
Yes, right, absolutely, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. German prisoners of war.
Right.
Yeah. December the 12th, there was an... this is kind of cute. December the 12th, there was an ad in the Marion Star for the Ohio Theater, advertising an upcoming movie called Swamp Water, which starred Walter Brennan and Walter Huston, two big names back then, Ann Baxter and Dana Andrews. And Dana Andrews made a lot of war pictures later on in his career. But four big days starting today, and this was on December the 12th at the Ohio Theater. Of course, we all know where the Ohio Theater is, down where the Eagles Lodge is now, or Elks, what is it? Elks Lodge.
I think
Lodge.
It's Elks, yes.
Elks Lodge, yeah, where the Opera House is and all that. But about halfway down the ad, it says, Scoop, in big letters, newsreels on the war on Japan, Hawaiian battle, and Roosevelt's speech. So they were going to include those newsreels in that particular ad for the movie. There was an ad then that occurred on December the 20th, 1941. Big letters, attention. My son enlisted in the air service, and I want to do my part to help win this war. After January the 1st, until further notice, I will charge on the regular commission on all public sales and return 50% of my commissions back to the owner in defense savings stamps. So they already started selling the savings stamps and savings bonds. Let's help keep them flying. Remember Pearl Harbor, big letters. Your sale is appreciated, large or small, anywhere, anytime. Call me, collect. Your auctioneer, F.E. Williams. And then dial 2786 was the number. Yeah. So people were patriotic. People were doing whatever they could to help support this war effort. A lot of, like you said earlier, a lot of factories were converted over to produce airplanes, tanks. Down in Lima, they started building tanks, munitions, bombs, whatever they could do. Of course, with all the men going off to war, both in the Pacific now and out in Europe as well, that brought the women into the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
So Rosie the Riveter, you know, started popping up. She was helping build airplanes. She was helping build bombs. Large production going on here in Marion then later on, where they were building munitions and sending them overseas. So a lot of stuff going on. Another article in the Marion Star, this one a little bit later on in December. Marion parents hear from their son in the war zone. Better keep this, Mom. Don't worry. This brief note was scribbled across the back of an envelope containing a government insurance policy received Monday from James E. Rinesmith by his parents, Mr. and Mrs. Edward Rinesmith of 360 Oak Street, not far from where we're sitting.
Right.
The envelope, postmarked Pearl Harbor, December the 13th, was the first word that they had received from him since the outbreak of the war on December the 7th, Mrs. Rinesmith said. Rinesmith is a third-class torpedoman. So he's either on a submarine or, like Don, he could be involved in, you know, one of the short carriers. A brother, Robert Rinesmith, is awaiting his first cruise on a destroyer. So they had two sons that were serving. And it always brings to mind, and I can never remember the full story, but you remember the story of the Sullivan brothers?
It sounds familiar.
The brothers, all the brothers, I think there were five brothers that went into the service, and they were all killed.
Okay.
Yeah, but one that wasn't allowed to go because Mom wouldn't let him go. So from that point on, then, they never took all in the same family, and they never let them serve all in the same place because all the brothers that were killed were on board, I don't know if it was a battleship or a submarine or what, but they were all together and killed at the same place. December the 8th, there were two editions put out that day of the Marion Star. There was an extra and then there was the regular home edition. The extra came a little bit, I think a little bit later in the day. The home edition was, or maybe that was first. The home edition came to the one that would have been carried to by the newsboys and delivered to your house. And this one, big headlines, U.S. declares war. So this would have been actually on the 8th after Roosevelt made his speech to the joint session of Congress. Big headlines, U.S. declares war. Jap attack on Hawaii called infamy. England acts, 3,000 dead and wounded in the attack on Hawaii. And you gave the number earlier, 2,403. Mm-hmm. And that didn't count, I don't think, the ones that were on land. I think that was just the ones that were involved in the on the aircraft carriers and the subs and so forth. So,
well, that attack certainly had a big effect on the morale and on the, you know, where the American people were going. I had read also that the Canadians were one of the first to enter the war after Pearl Harbor.
And a lot of guys that wanted to fly, because we weren't in the war in Europe, joined the Royal Air Force in Canada so they could become pilots and fly for Canada.
Okay, Fred, thank you. And please don't forget what happened that day at Pearl Harbor.
79 years ago.
79 years ago today.